This episode was created with the support of Free FM, Hamilton, New Zealand's community access media organisation. Visit us at freefm.org.nz.
The following contains graphic depictions of body horror. Hello, everyone. This will be a bit of a different episode today, as we're not doing our usual story show today, as we're going to be doing a bit of a history lesson. It is just myself, Zeb, the DM of this past campaign that you have been listening to.
Hi, Joseph. I play Amadeus.
And myself, Scott, usually Magnus, today history teacher.
Yes, as requested by the lovely folks at Free FM, we are going to be doing an episode on the history of tabletop role-playing games.
Nice.
Okay.
Over to you, Scott.
Sweet. I'll take it away. So basically, we're going to be following two threads until they come together with Gary Gygax. Really should put some dates down in the 70s, but we'll follow those threads separately first. You know, it's kind of helpful that it's in the name role-playing games. And to start with the role-playing. Role-playing, as far as we can tell anthropologically, role-playing goes back basically as far as human society. We have those cave paintings that you see all around the world. There's the universal sort of handprint on the wall, but usually there's also depictions of hunts and various animals and all sorts. And especially the caves in France, which are some of the best preserved. There was one, I forget the name of it, but Herner Herzog did a documentary on it, where essentially you've got these cave paintings of animals that are drawn in such a way where if you hold up torchlight, it's almost like an old school animation. And what is suspected is that these paintings were used in conjunction with storytellers to recreate great hunts or events in a tribe's history. And this is going more into sort of speculative anthropology, which, you know, we won't go into all the sources and citations and that kind of thing here. But there are theories that during these sessions, audience members would be invited to participate and take on the roles of people involved in those hunts. So you'd have a storyteller talking about how animals reacted and so forth, and the hunters, quote unquote, would interject to explain what their approach was or how they fought the great beast.
Or they made it all up and the first role-playing game existed.
Yeah. Well, we never know. They haven't found carved bone dice in the oldest.
Because there is dice from Egyptian times.
Speaking of, going into Egyptian times and Greek times, and unfortunately I will be quite Eurocentric in my telling here. My personal historical background doesn't really go into Native American histories or Asian African histories, although I'm sure there's similar sort of tendencies here among ancient civilizations, but lots of early...
Because people are people no matter where you go.
Yeah, but a lot of early religious practice had elements of role-playing. Usually if you were like a priest, to be inducted into like the higher levels of a priesthood, you would have to act out the mysteries of that particular cult. But the mysteries in Greece around Demeter and Persephone, which themselves was descended from Mycenaean practices, recreating the return of Persephone from the underworld, you would have people involved in that ritual recreating or taking on the role of Demeter, of Persephone, doing all that kind of thing. Another early thread is we've got early improvisational theatre, where people are making up scenarios and playing them out on a stage. So that's one of those threads, is this role-playing, which I think the strongest thread of that that went through was religious practice or improvisational theatre.
That's a weird come together of religion and theatre, considering how many times they hated each other.
Yeah.
Nah, man, the Greeks, it was all the same.
I'm more talking like...
The paths diverged and reconvened several times. And then you get into reenactments. I think the most famous early example that's happening is with the Romans and the Colosseums, where they do all sorts of fun stuff, like fill the Colosseum with water to reenact the naval battle. Unfortunately, they got a bit more physical than we would get during a game of Dungeons and Dragons.
And
stabby.
And speaking as a guy who's in LARPing before, we tend to avoid using sharp weapons.
Yes, early LARP's not very player friendly.
No, we're not.
That said, gladiatorial combat was nowhere near as deadly as media makes it out to be, because gladiators were expensive.
And they were basically the pop stars of...
The sport stars of the ancient Roman world. Anyway, that's a tangent.
You'd lose more gladiators to injury than actual slaying in the arena.
Yeah, anyway.
So those are the two threads that make up the role-playing element. Someone with a more solid background would probably be able to pull out more direct links, but you've got that historical reenactment. You've also got the idea of role-playing. Now, another area, and this is sort of getting into reenactment, but is more creative, would be wargaming. So you've got your super early war games like chess, which aren't especially deep, more of like a strategy game. In the 1800s, you get the Prussians, who were northern Germans, very obsessed with war. And a few officers in the Prussian military corps and their high command came up with actually several various different war games where they tried to simulate war. And their goal wasn't chess to create a fun experience where it's like a balanced game fighting each other. They wanted to recreate old battles or hypothetical new battles, and they were using it as a way of testing potential military endeavors, which reputedly was used to great success before the German wars in the 1860s, 1870s against the Danish, Austrians, and French. They wargamed out those scenarios, and depending on who you ask, that had quite a big influence on their success in those scenarios.
What a bunch of nerds.
They were some of the biggest dorks in history. Unfortunately, there's a direct line from them to Nazis, so that's also...
But let's not touch that subject with a 10-foot pole.
I mean, in most countries, you are a country with an army, and Prussia was an army that happened to have a country attached to it.
Oh.
Yeah, that's how seriously and big their army was.
Yeah, very importantly for us, though, I want to focus in on Kriegsspiel, which was one of the more successful ones. Kriegsspiel is still played today around the world. There's several servers and YouTube channels that you can watch that talk about Kriegsspiel and games and scenarios, and it's because it's probably about the most basic you can get a war game. Kriegsspiel is you have a map and you have blocks, or in the modern parlance, you probably have like a tabletop simulator with little blocks representing your units. Those sides are split among different players. You can have two-player games where it's one person controlling one army, one person controlling another. There's one that I participated in that had about 80 players.
Hot damn.
So you would have a grand commander and then several lower orders of commander.
I can imagine that got complicated fast.
It was extremely complicated. It had about a team of 7 game masters running it, and they were simulating things like fog of war. So in my experience of the game, I was a paratrooper division dropped behind enemy lines. I didn't have any contact with any of my friendly players until the last couple turns of the game. This game lasted almost a year. I got my orders at the start, and then I just had to try and figure out what to do.
So how many units were you technically in charge
of? I was in command of a division which was split into, like, I think 6 brigades. Well, 4 brigades, and then there was like an artillery unit and an engineer unit.
For our listeners who are hearing this and going, that sounds overwhelming. This is not normal. This is an atypical game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It was still pretty manageable because I basically just had to type out a paragraph each week saying, like, this guy does this, this guy does this, this guy does this. It turns out that I kept a lot of people occupied and allowed my team to win. I had no idea I was doing that.
But sounds about right. Anyway.
The thing that makes Kriegsspiel different, and the reason I'm bringing it up as a precursor to Dungeons & Dragons, is Kriegsspiel was a game with a game master, and the game master would determine the outcome of events. They would describe, this is what your men can see, this is what you perceive as the commander, and then the commander would tell them, these are the orders I give my subordinates. And then the game master would be like, okay, well, this guy gets shot on the way, this guy loses his message, and then describe the new, changed order of battle after resolution phase. To the extent of my knowledge, there's probably some kind of game that I've missed in the 1800s or 1700s that was different. But to the extent of my knowledge, this is the earliest game master role that you can draw a direct line to Dungeons & Dragons from. So the first game masters were weird northern Germans who had scars on their cheeks because when they were in high school, they slashed each other with swords.
To basically make themselves look cool.
And then pack it with horsehair.
Lovely.
Yeah. The nastier the scar, the cooler you were.
Oh, hell yeah.
Because people like looking cool for some reason. Anywho.
And so from there, we get miniature wargaming, which, interestingly enough, one of the earliest instances was H.G. Wells with his Little Wars. Yes, the author.
Yeah, I was about to say.
He was obsessed with playing with little soldiers.
Fair enough.
It didn't really catch on.
Book boy.
As far as I can tell, it wasn't really an excellent game, but you would take all the furniture out of your living room. What are you using it for? And you'd set up a miniature battlefield, and then you put all your soldiers around.
Yeah, no kidding, it didn't take on. That's a lot of work.
Move them around and shoot each other.
If it was played over a couple of days, okay, maybe, but if it's just, hey guys, want to move everything out of my lunch, play toy soldiers for like 3 hours.
Yeah.
Stuff that, modern furniture is heavy. Old furniture was heavier.
Yeah, because they built that stuff to last.
Stop that. But yeah, no, okay.
Yeah, so you have that. You also have some other attempts to get miniature wargaming started, like Robert Lewis in Scotland. I've actually forgotten what he did, but I think he was doing pewter miniatures or something like that. It sort of struggled to get started. It wasn't really until after World War II wargaming and miniature wargaming started to come into itself. I don't know what it is about the worst war in human history that encouraged people into these pursuits, but it's something I haven't researched enough to know much about. But I do know that there's an explosion of wargaming, and you get a lot of hex and shit war games, miniature war games start to be developed in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And this is where we start to directly get into our connections with D&D. So here's one of the examples of a direct line from wargaming to Dungeons & Dragons, which I will expand on later, was before Gary Gygax developed Chainmail into Dungeons & Dragons, he designed a naval war game. So one about battleships shooting each other. And there's a really fun fact about that that I'll go into after I talk about Braunsteins and Blackmore and all this sort of thing. So Dave Wesley is a guy who's been running these things called Braunsteins for the past 50-odd years. These are the first identifiable role-playing games. They're not commercially available or really commercially viable, although that might be changing shortly depending on how popular they get. They're a flexible role-playing experience. And the original Braunstein was simulating people across society in a Napoleonic village with all sorts of various backgrounds. The sequel was one set during a coup in a Latin American nation. So it's like a bit LARPy.
Yeah, I was about to say, this sounds like LARP settings.
LARPy, but with less. There's only one games master, but up to 30, 40 players.
Oh, to clarify, for those listening, LARP is live-action role-play.
Where basically people dress up as the characters and actually do the things instead of sitting around tables and talking about doing the things.
And as opposed to D&D and most common tabletop role-playing games, Braunsteins were encouraged to be competitive.
Oh.
You were not working together as a harmonious party. You were trying to actively kill, harm, or thwart the plans of other players.
Damn.
Player versus player in the early game.
Yeah. One of the offshoots of the Braunsteins was a cowboy game ran by a game called Dwayne Jenkins. And Dave Arneson started running a game in a fantasy setting. This is where we start to get a connection to Dungeons & Dragons as we know it. It was called Blackmore. I believe the Blackmore setting was developed into a D&D supplement at some point.
Yeah, that does sound familiar.
Yeah.
It was inspired by Conan and Lord of the Rings.
Everything fantasy from that time period was inspired by Lord of the Rings.
I think the three main inspirations that led into Dungeons & Dragons were the works of Vance, the Conan novels, and Lord of the Rings, and Moorcock has ideas of chaos and law, which literally became codified in Dungeons & Dragons, although they added good and evil, which was never really a thing in Michael Moorcock's work. That's all the Elric of Melniboné and that sort of thing. That's something I didn't actually put in the notes that's quite important, is the fiction inspirations for Dungeons & Dragons, all of which you can see really solid sort of links to. So like Lord of the Rings is where you get most of the racial archetypes from.
Yeah, the elf, dwarf, and halfling slash hobbit.
Yeah, Vance is where you get the magic from. The Vancean magic system was one where you would memorize a spell and then when you cast it, you would forget it. So that's where spell slots come from. Conan is...
It's where barbarians come from.
It's where barbarians come from. There's lots of ideas of what a hero does as an adventurer come from Conan.
Mm.
And then you've got law, chaos, the idea of planes and so forth coming from the Elric of Melniboné and Moorcock's work. But anyway, so Braunsteins weren't just free-form games like Kriegsspiel games. They would have a rule system. And here is where we get the seed of Dungeons & Dragons, is the Blackmore Braunstein used chainmail as a resolution system. Chainmail was a medieval war game, and it's essentially a D&D with no magic. It was originally designed for medieval mass combat, but what people did is they were, okay, well, I'll take a single soldier out, and we will resolve with that. Now, I might be going into apocryphal, half-remembered stuff here, but I think
I'm fairly certain Gary Gygax did a supplement or something like that that went into the whole, yeah, we're just going to be a bunch of singular guys rather than whole units.
So he's developed chainmail into a singular thing. I have here an excerpt from one of the Braunstein games, which I thought was amusing. There will be a medieval Braunstein at April 17th, 1971, at the home of Dave Anderson from 1300 hours to 2400 hours, with refreshments being available on the usual basis. It will feature mythical creatures and a poker game under the Trolls Bridge between sunup and sundown.
It's just like, okay, medieval fantasy, poker.
Yeah. That was one of the things about Braunstein's is you could have an in-character poker game running without disrupting the rest of the session because all the other players are off doing other adventures or going
through. Your character's just sitting down playing poker.
Yeah.
So it's D&D night and poker night all at once.
Yeah. So about 3 years before Dungeons & Dragons was released, Gygax was developing Dungeons & Dragons through his own world called Greyhawk. So Dave Arneson introduced Gygax to the concept of fantasy Braunstein through Blackmoor, and Gygax took chainmail and developed it into Dungeons & Dragons. And the really key innovation that Gygax added to chainmail was adding naval warfare rules to medieval combat. So in medieval combat, if a soldier gets hit by an arrow, they are removed from the battlefield because, well, they've either been injured and they can't fight anymore.
Or they're dead. Getting hit by an arrow sucks.
That's fine as well in Braunstein-style games, because if your character dies, cool, you get to make another character. Your protection is your armor. The better armor you have, the more protected you are. This doesn't really work for smaller Dungeons & Dragons-style role-playing, where you've only got a few characters. You don't want to be rolling up characters every now and then. As much as old hands love to talk about how back in my day we had to roll up 15 characters just to get through the entrance to the dungeon and all that kind of thing.
And then they would get so diabolically attached to their character that great misery was had when they actually died.
Yes, and 3d6 down the line.
3d6 down the line. But so what the two things that Gygax took from the naval war game, I think armor class might have already been in chainmail, but I'm not entirely sure. But armor class was something for the naval war games. It was what class of armor does this ship have? Does it have destroyer class armor, cruiser class armor? The thicker the armor, the lower the armor class, because originally, in the original conception, it was rolling to meet a particular number
to hit armor class zero.
To hit armor class zero.
Thaco, baby!
Thaco, we love it.
We hate it.
And that was because if you shot at a battleship with a small gun, it wouldn't do any damage, and that was to simulate that. So that innovation was taken and applied to the armor class of these particular adventurers, imagining it as relevant to chainmail or plate mail or what have you. The other one was hit points, because once again, even if you fire a battleship shell at a battleship and it penetrates the armor and explodes, it is not generally going to sink that battleship immediately. That battleship will still continue to fight. And the war game that Gygax had developed, battleships had a number of hit points that were required to be removed from the ship before it would sink and be no longer effective. So Gygax took the idea of hit points and applied it to these individual superhuman adventurers. And that's how naval wargaming and these Braunstein adventurers came together to form our first Dungeons & Dragons creations.
I mean, it's my understanding, and I could be completely wrong, that a lot of the early D&D rules referenced a lot of the chainmail rules.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Because, and for a lot of people, you needed the chainmail rules to be able to run D&D.
I think the very earliest versions, when it was sort of playtesting, were like that, but the red box that was released, the first big DSR project product, D&D was all in one box.
D&D 1, before AD&D.
Yeah, because I was listening to a podcast somewhere about all the fanzines that sprung up around the time would have people sharing their house rules because you could only find chainmail in like certain part of the country, and if you didn't live in that part of the country, good luck, bucko.
Fanzines were huge. Dragon magazine was massive as a way of sharing rules and all that kind of thing.
It was also where some really cursed information came out about certain things.
Such as?
Drow pregnancies.
Good times. So there's also a few other tabletop RPGs that I won't go into for the interest of time that sort of were finding their feet around this time. There was RuneQuest and Traveller. Those are two of the more enduring early RPGs. There were a lot of others. After D&D became quite popular, there was an explosion of tabletop RPGs around the world.
Because it was, all of a sudden, people knew what to do.
People knew what to do, and it was very low cost of entry if you were publishing, because, as Joseph said, you could just do a fanzine.
Traveller's 4th or 5th edition of it.
Traveller's interesting, because Traveller has, they release new editions, but sometimes it's going back to, the original Traveller is still technically support, if that makes sense. It hasn't been abandoned, they're all in parallel.
Yeah, and then RuneQuest has been morphed into the basic role-playing system, because the company that produces it, Chaosium, basic role-playing system is the core for a lot of their, well, is the core system for their two major lines, RuneQuest, which they published first in the 70s, and then in 81 they released what would be their surprisingly more popular game in Call of Cthulhu, based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft, and
Pendragon more recently.
Well, I mean, even Pendragon was an old game, but they've recently brought back, and surprisingly,
incredible book.
Yeah, and surprisingly, there is a connection between D&D and Call of Cthulhu, because in 3.5, the 3.5 edition of D&D, they released, was it Deities and Demigods?
Yeah.
And it had a whole bunch of the Cthulhu mythos in it.
Which is wild that, for whatever reason, the Cthulhu mythos keeps creeping into so many different...
Well, it's because it's not licensed.
Well, the major problem that they ran into was...
Chaosium going, Chaos, no!
Well, no, it's not even that. It's like, Chaosium's like, hey, that looks suspiciously familiar. Okay, thanks, WTF. And then...
give us your money.
Yeah, basically, because while the works of Lovecraft and some of his contemporaries are in the public domain and you're free to use the name Cthulhu and whatever the heck you like, you know, Chaosium did a lot of...
specific clarification.
Like, specific, well, expanding and refining the mythos into a more cohesive thing, because Lovecraft and his contemporaries, Derleth and...
The guy who wrote King in Yellow.
The King in Yellow and stuff, they basically made it coherent. Prior to that, it was basically just...
a collection of short stories that weren't always cognizant with each other.
Yeah, while they were playing in the same sandbox and using the same themes and ideas and stuff, yeah, basically. So, Chaosium was like, hey, that looks... please don't. unless you give us money. And so, at the end, they withdrew Deities and Demigods... stripped out a lot of the mythos stuff.
Actionable material,
and then republished it with... but that's my contribution to this history lesson.
Thank you very much. So, Gygax releases Dungeons & Dragons. Obviously, huge sales, colossal success. So, to further develop product, he starts this company called TSR. Gygax starts TSR with the Bloom Brothers, and... it's really, the history of TSR would be an entire podcast episode in itself. It is incredibly complicated. There is lots of people dying and ownership being transferred all over the place.
It was a mess.
Through several deaths and transfers and purchases and so forth, Lorraine Williams ends up with enough power to remove Gygax from the company in 1983, when TSR also splits into a bunch of companies.
We don't want you no more.
Gygax gets removed, and then Dungeons & Dragons has its best 10 years. He created the original system. He was also... had some very interesting personal views, which we don't need to go into. But in terms of business and taking D&D to stratospheric heights, the TSR of the late 80s, early 90s was really where it was cooking. A lot of the products and things that D&D is known for come from this age. So this is when the Forgotten Realms comes into prominence. Planescape, it's the early development cycles of the classic role-playing games such as Baldur's Gate that are associated with Dungeons & Dragons. There's also some maybe less wildly popular stuff like Dark Sun and Spelljammer come from this time. Then you've got...
Dragonscape.
Kingmaker.
No, not Dragonscape. No. Dragonlance.
Okay, Dragonlance was wildly successful.
True.
Because that was essentially, they got a bunch of fantasy authors to write novels set in the Dragonlance setting and then made role-playing tie-ins, which was so successful that they ended up doing novel tie-ins for all their settings. Once again... lots of complicated things. The company gets muddled in. They don't really do a good enough job of protecting their IP. So they have individual authors and content creators content creators, this is the 90s we're talking about, who are just suing each other, who are working for technically the same company.
Good job.
Complicated to get into. The company is at dire straits, and they get purchased by Wizards of the Coast. Wizards of the Coast was a card game company at this point.
They did Magic.
They were doing Magic. I think they also licensed the early runs of Pokemon cards in
English. They did.
And then Wizards of the Coast is acquired by Hasbro in 1999. Very miserable time. In that time frame from between the 1970s and 1980s, Dungeons and Dragons goes through a couple of editions. There's basic D&D, which is published all the way through to the 90s, and that's more or less unchanged from the original Red Box system. I think the last major release for it was the Dungeons and Dragons Cyclopedia, which was all-in-one Monster Manual, Dungeon Master's Guide and Player's Handbook.
Okay.
Give us one of those for the current systems, please.
Oh, I used to own a copy. It was a great book. And then there was Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which went from Advanced Dungeons & Dragons to 2nd Edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons, which was basically just 2nd Edition D&D, which all three of them were technically, to some extent,
Interplayable,
but not really.
You could, but you shouldn't.
2nd Edition had a huge spread of extra material because TSR was basically publishing anything. It led to some sort of silly stuff. There's a whole Mongolian-themed campaign box you can get, which had some interesting stuff going on. There was an entire source book for being a ninja. But yeah, lots of different splat books and all completely incoherent because it's just anyone could create content for it. There wasn't much of a general oversight of balance or content direction, which worked to its credit in terms of allowing for things like Planescape and Forgotten Realms to gain prominence, but also meant there was Demi-Humans source book, which had a bunch of alternate races that you could start as.
And then there was this might be for 3rd edition, but there was one book that had a bunch of sex-based classes.
That was 3rd edition.
That's 3rd edition, and that's because of the OGL. But yeah,
I'm getting ahead of things, Dan.
You're jumping ahead.
You're listening to Tales from the Guild, Shadows of Paradigm.
Speaking of 3rd edition, you have Monte Cook, Jonathan Tweet, and Skip Williams, who were brought in by Wizards to create a 3rd edition of Dungeons & Dragons. This is the basis of the D20 gaming system, which is still quite popular today, mostly through its sort of spiritual successor, Pathfinder.
And itself.
Pun?
And D&D. It's
D&D 5e is not D20 system.
Isn't it?
It's its own new...
It's a D20 based system,
yeah.
But it's not the D20 system.
I'd probably say D20 inspired.
Yeah.
I did not realize there was a specific system called the D20 system.
The D20 system, think of your classic 3.5 style.
I know how 3.5 and Pathfinder First E work. Okay. I mean, I've learned a lot of new things today, but
Neat.
I think they've still called it some version of the D20 system, but the 5th edition and 5.5 are both
their own thing. Okay, fair enough.
I think part of that is for licensing purposes. Part of that is also just...
Again, we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah, 3rd edition D&D is wildly successful. Wizards put a lot of effort into creating some very nice source books for it. They are beautiful, if you can ever find them. But it's also heinously unbalanced. And that's not to say that 2nd edition wasn't also heinously unbalanced, but 2nd edition D&D didn't quite have the level of, if you know what you're doing in 3rd edition, you can just create an unstoppable beast.
Just play a wizard in any D&D game, you win.
In the earlier editions, wizards are pathetic.
That's because Gygax hated spellcasters.
You know, there's the reason that there's the wizard dies from 1d4 insert thing here damage.
Yeah,
but yeah, no.
3rd edition spellcasters are juiced.
Yeah,
they put the roid into the spellcasting.
And with the way that multiclassing worked in 3rd and the way that spells worked in 3rd, there was literally no reason to be a fighter or barbarian or anything like that, because a spellcaster could do anything a fighter could do, but better. There's a balance patch, 3.5, which
did
carries
not
on for
fix anything.
7 years. Compared to 3rd, 3.5 is a huge improvement, which should tell you how bad 3rd edition was.
It was broken, but it was not as broken.
And one of the big things that came from this was the D20 rules were released under an open games license, the OGL. So anyone could make a hack of the game for commercial purposes, and I think you didn't even have to give Wizards a kickback.
You still don't, I believe.
They tried
to do that, and everyone said no.
I think if you release it through D&D Beyond, there's kickbacks. But
that's because Wizards of the Coast own that website. Yeah. That's fair.
And I think you couldn't use certain copyrighted material.
Yeah.
For the most part, you could take the rules and use them however you liked under the OGL, but yeah, stuff
you couldn't take Mind Flayers.
There's Mind Flayers and certain other...
Yeah, creatures and spells. You had to, like, make a generic name for the spell.
Which is fair enough. But basically, from my understanding of it, is they released a basic stripped-down version of the rules and said, here, you can anyone can use this.
Basically, yeah.
As long as you say, this is where it's from.
Basically, you had to include the OGL in the back of the book.
Yeah.
Basically say, you know, this is the legal shenanigans. Other than that, you didn't have to kick back to Wizards or Hasbro, and you could, you know, make whatever the heck you want.
And it was actually probably one of the biggest reasons for the eventual complete spectrum dominance of Dungeons & Dragons, because
it was a good system and people couldn't just add stuff to it.
Arguable on the good system. More, it was a ready-made system and you could just plug anything into it, which... A lot of licenses.
It was a good system in that people found it fun.
It's a good system in that A, found it fun, B, somebody had already done the legwork.
Yeah.
The basic legwork of, here's a system that you don't have to design from scratch that's already been playtested because...
That's what they put their money into.
And so it works.
Yeah, you don't have to build everything from scratch. So you get lots of licensed products releasing D20 hacks. There's a Star Wars one, there's a Game of Thrones one. I think there was a Game of Thrones one released before the Game of Thrones TV show, based entirely on the books, which is quite interesting. I think it's got rules for holding lands and all that kind of thing.
I got a copy of that book at Convergence last year.
Oh, crazy.
You can generate your own house.
Yeah.
Nice.
Like from scratch. And build, like, your house's lands and how old it is.
Yeah, basically rebuilding Birthright from base principles.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and so, and this kind of sounds crazy now, given how long 5th edition has been established. But Wizards releases 4th edition in 2007, so only 4 years after 3.5 comes out.
Damn.
And 4th edition is heavily influenced by...
World of Warcraft.
Well, yeah, World of Warcraft, but it's also an attempt by Wizards to move away from the original kind of a bit hacky DNA of the original Dungeons & Dragons and move to a more refined, balanced system.
And from the sounds of it, it was very balanced, which people hated for some reason.
For a lot of players, it felt like it didn't really matter what you chose because a lot of the effects didn't have much texture. It did do something quite cool in that it made every class have abilities, but every class had the same number of abilities. So a wizard would have three different spells, and then a fighter would have three different fighter maneuvers that operated almost like spells.
Right.
You'd have your basically encounter powers, your at-will powers, your daily powers.
Right, and it ended up feeling like nobody really had a true identity then.
Yeah, it was also not backwards compatible.
And from what I've heard, combat was a nightmare to run because there was like about 50 different effects going off at any given time that could change how combat worked.
Yeah, it wasn't beginner-friendly, definitely. The biggest problem was when they first released it, the monster manual, the hit point totals for all the monsters was doubled.
Oh, yeah, they were accidentally doubled, yeah.
So combat felt super spongy. The combat was actually, I would say, is probably the most interesting Dungeons & Dragons combat has ever been, because unlike every other edition that has said, oh, well, you know, it's designed as a grid-based combat system, but you can do it theater of the mind, they're actually like, no, you bring a grid and you use it. I think they might have even had a grid printed at the back of the book, so you could use the book as your battle grid.
That's nice. Smart.
Or was that third edition? It was one of them. I've got them at home.
It's also where you could start photocopying them.
That was all the way back. There's always been photocopying with Dungeons & Dragons.
True. No idea how old photocopiers are.
And to
older than you'd think.
And to be fair, that's how a lot of the zines were produced, was basically they'd put it, the zine together and basically just...
Photocopy it.
Photocopy. They'd have the mailing list and they'd just, well, we need 80 copies to send out this month, so photocopy 80 copies of it and bing it in letters and out you go.
Bring back fanzines.
If it isn't obvious, I am the youngest member of this group.
Yeah, well, in a minor tangent to 4th edition, we've referenced Pathfinder a couple of times. Now, the company that produces it, Paizo, started as a licensee of WotC during 3rd edition and 3.5.
Yep.
They produced the Dungeons magazine and the Dragons magazine. I forget which is which, but one was a magazine for players and one was a magazine for
GMs.
So they started doing that, and then WotC cancelled the license for it when 4th edition came out so that they could do the magazines in-house. And seeing how much of a
Backlash.
Backlash, they came for 4th edition. Paizo created what is now 1st edition Pathfinder as basically D&D 3.75.
Yeah.
A lot of fun. Far more balanced than...
But still broken.
Oh, horrendously broken. The ability to fart out, like, 300-400 damage a turn is very easy to do.
Yeah, that was Paizo basically trying to capture the still-existing market for 3rd edition and 3.5, because while they could use the basic stuff like wizards, fighters, they didn't have warlocks, because I think that was a...
That was a 4th edition.
Started out in 3rd edition.
I think that the 5th edition warlock
I believe
4th
that.
Edition... lineage.
Yeah, but yeah, so like, there wasn't stuff like warlocks, but a lot of basic classes like fighter, wizard, sorcerer, paladin, they were all...
Yeah,
I believe the core 12 classes of Pathfinder...
Were basically the core classes of 3rd edition 3.5.
Also now the core classes of 5th edition.
So for the duration of 4th edition, Pathfinder outsold Dungeons & Dragons because... People were buying that over 4th edition.
They also were one of the really early pushes of PDFs and online.
Yeah.
You can find all of Pathfinder's rules online for free with a company-sponsored website.
Yeah, well, company-licensed.
Company-licensed.
Probably sponsored too, to be fair. But yeah, these days... There's a website called Archives of Nethys, because in the Pathfinder universe, Nethys is the god of knowledge. You can find all the rules for all the systems that Paizo produces. Pathfinder 1st edition, Pathfinder 2nd edition, which is their current edition.
Starfinder.
Starfinder 1st edition and Starfinder 2nd edition. And yeah, they're all there for free. Unlike WotC, and this isn't a dig at WotC, Paizo releases officially endorsed PDFs of all of their products. APs, rule sets, you know, campaigns, rule sets, everything.
Yep.
Yeah.
And the general $20.
That's it. You can, they're not technically PDFs, but if you get the books of D&D Beyond, it's kind of the same, just more expensive.
Yeah, and you don't have to pay a monthly fee for it.
Yeah.
You just get the PDFs and they're on your
phone. Anyway, let's stop bashing companies that we don't want coming up.
I wasn't trying.
Yeah.
This is what they do as opposed to watching. Yeah. As opposed to...
Fourth edition struggles along for another 5 years, and then there's a fifth edition in a playtest packet. Essentially, what fifth edition was an attempt to do was an attempt to reconcile the gameplay changes that people appreciated from third edition with the second edition approach to the game. Core among this was the concept of kits, which changed into archetypes to give more texture to each of the character classes, and then the idea of proficiencies instead of skills. Skills in a third edition context are things that I'll put 1 point into my sleight of hand skill or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas proficiencies are just something you have and then you get a fixed bonus.
I would not be surprised in the slightest if a lot of computer RPGs with the whole concept of skill points came from 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons. I don't know if it is. Don't come after me if it's not.
The other thing that they took from the earlier editions was the idea of a bounded AC. In 3rd edition and 4th edition, armor classes and attack bonuses got inflated dramatically at higher levels.
Plus 40 to hit.
Yeah. There's sort of, not exactly hard caps, but it's a lot more limited in 5th edition. I think what the highest AC you'll face in general material is 30, and that's for like a truly ridiculous...
30? Okay. The highest AC I've seen on a monster is 24.
Yeah.
Characters can cheese their way up to 30.
Yeah, but you're not getting the 50 AC that you would see in...
Like, on average, the AC of most monsters and characters is 18.
The numbers don't go crazy.
Which is nice.
Which is nice. They're basically huge simplification, streamlining of the rules, da-da-da-da-da.
In some cases, detrimentally so, because, that's personal opinion. But, yeah, no, 5th edition, very nice system to run.
Yeah, of the Dungeons & Dragons, it is...
The most successful.
The most successful, definitely. Probably the most developed. Not entirely sure on 5.5. It's added a bit more source.
In general, 5.5 is an upgrade to 5th edition.
Yeah. I think there's more to keep track of, which might hinder its...
There is. Not by much.
Mm.
Unfortunately, having come into D&D from 1st edition Pathfinder, I haven't played 5.5, so I won't comment on that. Coming into 5th edition from Pathfinder, where there's... So much math.
Yeah.
You can throw together a first level character in 5 and 5.5 D&D. 30 minutes. Pathfinder 1E, first level character, 2 hours minimum.
Yeah. That's actually something I did want to talk about a bit, because in the 2010s and 2020s, lower complexity games start to be developed. Because
there's now so many one-page RPGs out there.
Yep, not even necessarily just one-page RPGs, longer RPGs, but with rules that are much simplified.
Because Fate.
I mean, Fate's been around for a while. Powered by the Apocalypse.
Powered by the Apocalypse, which is in the show notes. Powered by the Apocalypse, originally Apocalypse World, which is a playbook-focused role-playing game with really simple rules. You roll 2d6 if you get, I think it's 8.
Yeah, 7 or 8. And a higher.
And a higher, you succeed. There's bounded 6 with circle of drawback, so that's the rule for resolution. And then to create a character, you take a book that has a bunch of predefined rules in it and you just tick the ones you want. But which basically means that you can sit at a table and you can start playing within 5 minutes, as opposed to a table of D&D where you generally will need, you know, a session zero where you spend 3 hours going over characters, having discussions about what to create. You can make a character, and if you're rushing, you can make a character in like 10 minutes less.
Yeah, because it's...
Session Zero is more than just character creation, but that is for another episode.
And what generally mean my books in the Powered by Apocalypse is the oak types. In Apocalypse World, it might be... I think there's like the loner, which is the Mad Max.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, the... Yeah, so they're like oak types for whatever genre the system is going for, like...
Yeah.
Apocalypse and all this other stuff.
So I think one of the most famous Powered by the... Well, there's two really famous Powered by the Apocalypse spin-offs. One of them is the Avatar Last Airbender role-playing game, which I have not played. I do hear it's an example of one where it's essentially 3.5 license bashing again, where someone's taken an established system and slapped a license on it and called it a good day. But that's from more academic TTRPG-invested people who were disappointed that there wasn't a developed bespoke system. It can't please everyone.
And frankly, making a bespoke system for Avatar honestly be a bit more complicated than it's worth.
Yeah, you'd end up with something that's Shadowrun.
Yeah.
Which is a very complicated system. The other one is Blades in the Dark, which is extremely popular. Recently, Blade 68.
Blades in the Dark came out, 2018, 2020? I know it's new-ish.
It's relatively new. I forget the exact time it came out.
Hold up, we have access to the internet.
There's also the old school revival movement, which really kicked into gear in the 2010s. Entirely full of savoury characters, although there's some good people in there.
Yeah, you got things like Shadow Dark RPG.
Morkborg.
Oh, Morkborg.
Dungeon Crawl Classics.
I mean,
2017. Blades in the Dark was 2017. Mm.
Morkborg is... I haven't played it, but I've heard nothing but good things.
It's amazing. The Morkborg is... And there's even online tools for Morkborg.
From what I understand, Morkborg is as much a stylistic choice as it is a role-playing game.
Yeah, the role-playing element of it is incredibly bare bone. I think it might have even cut down the stats to 3. I forget exactly. But it's you have a character, your character... Hopefully has a weapon.
I like
that's what you mean. Hopefully.
Well, you might just have a shard of bone.
Ah.
You can play it completely bare bones without even character classes.
Nice.
And you basically just roll a character. That character has some kind of neuroses, and then you go out to die. It is an incredibly lethal
This character,
world.
Along with everyone else, is suicidal. They're here to die. Yeah,
but the intent of games like Morkborg, a lot of the old school revival games, is to peel back all the mechanics so you can get more into the role play, more into that collaborative storytelling between Dungeon Master and player, where instead of rolling to check for traps, the Dungeon Master describes a hallway, and if the players aren't interested in exploring that, like, do I see anything near the ground? Maybe I'm going to pat the walls or something like that.
Dungeons & Dragons started out as a survival horror game. And OSR games, old school revival games, a lot of them go back to that, this is a survival horror game. Stuff's broken. The world sucks. Live with it.
Sounds like fun, actually. But then again, my first campaign was called Cthulhu.
Yeah.
Mass of Nyarlathotep, which is... Whoa.
Yeah, OSR games have reached a point where not all of them are trying to get back to the survival horror. It's more about having the simplicity of the system. Because there's also old school revival, but for traveler likes.
Basically, to take things back to a quote-unquote simpler time.
Yeah, it's to change the focus away from spending 45 minutes crafting a character sheet and more, okay, we've got our randomly generated character, that's a big part of it. I'm going to see what they do in this world.
Yeah, which can be really fun. It can also, honestly, this is quite frankly the rule with any game. Depends on the group you're with.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's where another one of the more recent innovations has a huge impact on tabletop role-playing games. That is lovely Kickstarter and all the other crowdfunding platforms, which have made it a lot more accessible for indie developers to create and publish their games.
The Cosmere RPG.
Mothership, Lancer, Dot Dungeon,
yes.
Wander Home. There's literally tens of thousands. There are so uncountable. Many. There's also itch.io.
Yeah, and you've got a whole lot of third-party content, yeah. D&D, Pathfinder.
Drive-through RPG.
Drive-through RPG is great because a lot of companies now are releasing equivalents to the OGL. They'd be like, here, these are our rules.
Yep.
You can't use any of our copyrighted materials,
yep.
Say for XYZ ad. You're allowed to release settings and scenarios and...
Those kind of legal documents are how those games get longevity. It's how video games that are easy to mod survive. It's why Skyrim and Fallout 4 have existed in the...
cultural zeitgeist for so long, yeah.
Yeah, because... There's 5 new mods getting created for those games every day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's Drive-Thru RPG, the
itch.io.
And Humble Bundle, and a couple of other bigger publishers have their own
storefronts
where you can find their specific stuff if you want to.
Companies like Loot Tavern, Ghostfire Gaming, Meichan Press.
And the indie side of publishers also have their own websites where they're selling their stuff.
Chaosium.
Mongoose.
Mongoose.
There's lots out there.
There's so many.
Yeah, Paizos.
The accessibility to customers, the ability to market across the internet, the ability to deliver digital PDFs.
Oh, yeah. No, the internet has done wonders for TTRPGs.
YouTube and, ironically, podcasting.
Critical Role.
Yeah.
Has helped immensely because...
It's modeled how to play tabletop.
That's both a blessing and a curse because
every player expects their DM to be like
Brendan Lee Mulligan or Matthew Mercer
and every DM expects their players to be like Sam Riegel.
I don't expect you guys to be like Sam Riegel. I just expect you guys to show up and play a character, not just, hi, my name's Bob. I don't like how that shopkeeper is talking to me. I stab the shopkeeper.
I mean, that's a character.
I like to think that the three of us, when we're all here, are sufficiently characterized up to, you know, have fun.
The pains of my existence.
Honestly, I am surprised you don't have white hair.
I'm having fun too.
Fair enough. But yeah, so the internet, through both buying games.
Also being able to play remotely through Skype and eventually Discord.
Platforms like Roll20.
VT, Virtual Tabletop.
Foundry.
Foundry. There's a recent pay-to-play connection.
It practically boomed during all the various COVID lockdowns because people couldn't leave their houses. And it's like...
I want to talk with my friends. Let me play games.
That certainly helped.
There's been a few attempts to dethrone Dungeons & Dragons. Probably the most credible one was Pathfinder.
Yeah. Pathfinder did succeed for a time.
And for the most part, D&D is the granddaddy.
Yes.
Except when you go to places like Japan.
Yeah.
Where...
It never really penetrated the market.
Yeah,
What's that big Japanese one called? It's like Sword something or other.
Yeah, I have the playtest of the English version of that. And also, Call of Cthulhu is popular in Japan.
Oh, hell yeah.
Because...
They've still got quite a big indie scene as well.
Yeah.
Old school style.
And then you've got the likes of Fabula Ultima, which is based on the Final Fantasy tropes.
There's been a few big Kickstarters. They've never really come close to overtaking Dungeons & Dragons. There's Lancer was a very big mech combat one, but too niche. Interestingly enough, that one drew
Sword
more
World, that's what
on,
it's called.
Yeah.
That one drew more on 4th edition than any other background.
Yeah, so... Unfortunately, D&D has pretty much cemented itself as...
Basic go-to. It'll be interesting to see how the industry and culture develops, because I definitely think a lot of the dynamism of tabletop RPGs is how influential individual creatives can be. Someone can come up with an idea, develop it into something and generally kickstart it and reach a lot of people.
It's why, and again, to bring up the Cosmere RPG, that earned several million dollars of recent Kickstarter for third-party material. Mm. Mythozoology for 5e also hit $3-4 million.
Oh, there was Daggerheart as well.
Daggerheart did really well.
People.
I mean, it's even offshooting, you know, traditional media. Looking at you, Critical Role, with your two cartoons based on D&D campaigns.
For now.
Yeah.
Shut up.
There's not discussions about a movie. They haven't outright said.
The Fallout TV series.
Yeah.
Which
did really well. And the Sonic films.
Sonic films for video games.
Yeah.
The D&D movie. Yeah. Did a great job of capturing the whole general feel.
Well, even, I think Baldur's Gate was huge as well.
Yeah, yeah. Baldur's Gate 3.
That's the more recent one. With
yeah.
The,
yeah.
Okay.
Probably the best captured tabletop experience in a video game.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, actually, no, Divinity Original Sin had a bit more creativity to it.
But that was its own original system.
Yeah, in terms of taking an existing tabletop system and making a playable experience, Baldur's Closest.
Baldur's Gate does a pretty good job, again, from what I understand. I mean, heck, Mortal Kombat, in terms of video games, has also done pretty well, movie and TV-wise.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, anyway, games are permeating pop culture. It's great. Love it. I'm waiting for somebody to figure out how to do Call of Cthulhu as a television series, because
honestly, I'd be down for a Call of Cthulhu CRPG in the veins of, like,
there's definitely been at least one released.
Oh, there's a Call of Cthulhu video game.
There's several.
At least, you know, if you want something in the vein of Call of Cthulhu, there's a couple of SCP Foundation video games that capture that sort of normal person trying to survive against things that should not be.
The problem there is more like the general aversion of game developers when it comes to horror. It's more of an indie lead.
I fully understand why there will likely not be one, because as much as I'm a fan of Call of Cthulhu as a system, it can be incredibly niche in that not only is it a horror role-playing game, which is strike one, you play very squishy humans.
If you make it a looter, shooter, extractor, battle royale.
Ah, Delta Green.
I think on that note, that is a good place to... Nothing more on your notes?
No, nothing really. I would mostly just say, if you're in any way interested in tabletop role-playing games, I would investigate the wide world of them. Have a look across websites like DriveThruRPG and Itch.io. There's a lot of free-to-download ones across both. You can often get a demo version of a full game. Look for a setting or an idea that compels you. Give it a try with some friends.
Yeah.
And if you're looking for people to play with, hit the Waikato Role-Playing Guild up. That's what we're all a part of, and we are an ever-growing community.
And we do have Convergence coming up in September.
Yes.
Which is basically a bunch of nerds getting together to play and run a variety of different games and different systems and different genres and other things. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Google is your friend, ladies and gentlemen. Google is your friend. But keep the safe search on. Dear God, please keep it on.
And on that note, this has been Tales from the Guild. As always, there will be more stories to share, and apparently history lessons as well, when next we meet. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have at the moment. There is more to this story that will be shared when next we meet.
This Free FM podcast was brought to you with support from New Zealand On Air.